Hello and welcome to the House of Comments. We hope you enjoy this episode. If you do, please subscribe on iTunes and don't forget to rate and review us. It helps other people find the podcast too. Also, tell your friends. You can follow us on Twitter at HOC Podcast. And please, please do get involved in the discussion, preferably as politely as possible. Thank you very much. And welcome to this week's edition of the House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm joined by Mark Thompson, who's a political commentator. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
And Nick Dennis, who is with the Tory Workers. Hi, Nick.
Hiya.
I hope everybody enjoyed the interview we had with Joe Swinson last week. If you haven't yet heard it, do go back and have a listen. But this week there's been quite a lot going on, so I think we're just going to plough straight forward. The biggest story, certainly in the UK this week, seems to have been the attempted murder, potentially still could be a murder, of two former Russian citizens in a sleepy town in the UK. We are led to understand, I believe the government has said, it seems very likely that this was at the very least sanctioned by the Russian government, if not carried out by them. This has been refuted by the Russian embassy, but then in the words of Mandy Rice Davis, he would say it, wouldn't he? So we are now in a situation where there's not for the first time, we are looking at some very, very scary extra legal activity being carried out by people who just think they're beyond the law. What can we do about this, Nick?
Wow, what a big question.
That's what the podcast is for.
It is in such a bind. I mean, obviously, Russia at the moment is having a presidential election, which, of course, in many ways is a foregone conclusion because we all know Putin is very much going to win. But like a lot of these things, it isn't as obvious it might first seem. And there are quite a few sort of different groups below Putin jostling for power. So Putin might not have ordered this or known about this, but certainly some apparatus or part of the government in Russia must have been involved in order to get and smuggle over such a dangerous chemical over here. So, you know, I think this is a very unstable situation. Honestly, I think we have to make a big statement about this, because ultimately this type of thing cannot be allowed to get away with. And one of the things we've certainly seen with Russia, who essentially act like bullies, and we've seen them in different places, Syria, amongst others, is if you don't deal with them strongly, then they will believe that they can do whatever they want and will continue to do whatever they want.
Yeah, I mean, that is that's the problem, isn't it? Because yeah, we had this was it 10 years ago now with Alexander Litvinenko?
Yeah, 12 years ago. It's 2006, I think.
Wow, gosh, doesn't time fly? And, you know, nothing ever really happened and it just sort of went away. And if that happens again, I mean, this is a question of where legalities and international diplomacy has to meet. And we know that that it's not as simple as you've broken the law, you have to pay for it. And there are difficulties in terms of international diplomacy, but we've got to do something, haven't we? I mean, this just can't be allowed to continue. Mark, what's your thinking?
I mean, I'm not really sure what we can do, to be honest. I mean, I think it's dreadful that what looks like either some people who are close to Putin, or maybe, perhaps even more scarily, it might be people who have gone rogue. Maybe Putin didn't order this. I mean, you know, the chemical weapon that's been used here, I can't imagine that all of it that was created during the Soviet years is still under lock and key. I'm sure some of it's kind of got out and has got into the hands of people who maybe aren't in control of being controlled by the Kremlin. But whether it is or it isn't, I'm not really sure what we can do. I don't think there's any sanctions that we can really use against Russia that are going to make that much difference. I think they're just pretty much a rogue state now.
Well, we've got to engage the international community, and as an international community, essentially then put sanctions in. I mean, I know it goes against the sort of grain of the world at the moment, which is quite scary. But obviously, this attack on our soil is an attack on our soil. But actually, it threatens any other Western country. This type of brazen behaviour. So the EU, the USA need to come together and put sanctions on Russia to make sure that they know that this sort of thing is unacceptable. I mean, whether that can happen or not in the current sort of isolationist climate, I don't know.
I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, technically, as a member of NATO, that should be a one for all attack on one of us is attack on all of us, but the reality very much doesn't sort of match that rhetoric. And does it, I mean, does NATO mean anything without that reality? You know, these are big, big questions that we are going to have to spend, you know, this century struggling with, because I don't believe that we are in the kind of internationalist space that we were when things like the United Nations and NATO and the EU were created. So, you know, all the isolationism that some are embracing, some are not embracing, but having forced upon us, it does mean that we don't have the backup of allies in the way that we once would have just expected naturally. I mean, at the moment, we can't even seem to decide not to attend or, you know, not to have Russia host the World Cup. If we can't even stop the World Cup, what can we do in terms of actual international diplomacy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's worrying. I mean, one thing for certain, though, is that we need more than a robust conversation with Russia. We need to do something, because, you know, the robust conversation doesn't work. And, I mean, to sort of maybe move the discussion a little bit onto something more back to home, I mean, I was actually shocked by Jeremy Corbyn's response in the House of Commons, I have to admit. I'm obviously not a Corbyn fan at all, but, I mean, he seemed to really underplay the whole situation as far as I could see.
Yeah, no, I it didn't feel like there was enough being taken seriously. And I mean, I was quite impressed by John McDonnell sort of saying, look, we're not going to do Russia today anymore. These are not good things. But unfortunately, that seemed to then be denied by the leader's office. So I'm not sure what the position is on that now. And yeah, we do need to I think that there is a misunderstanding, a misconception about Russia as that it sees everything as America is the great demon, and therefore if you're against America, you're against the great demon and therefore are a good guy. And it's just a very, very simplistic view of both America, which, I mean, I understand people who have a lot of problems with America's foreign policy over the years, who doesn't, but I also don't think that simply aligning yourself against America is the right approach. Trying to change how America approaches foreign policy is absolutely the right approach. But you can't do that by simply just aligning yourself with every kook that comes along and says they're bad guys. And, you know, Putin's not a good guy. He's not some sort of radical socialist that's going to, you know, the weird part of this is that the people that we're aligning, that the left are sometimes aligning themselves with, are oligarchs. That doesn't shout to me of this is the kind of people that we as socialists should be on the side of.
Well, you can't get a cigarette paper between Donald Trump and Jeremy Corbyn when it comes to Russia.
Well, yeah, and that's just, well, I mean, I wouldn't say that's exactly right, but I certainly don't believe that Jeremy Corbyn is being helped in any elections by the Russians, although I would be interested.
Not yet.
Well, I don't think anyone expected him to do anything on his own, so I don't think it was needed. But I do think that I mean, if we're going to go down that route, I think that there is some questions to be asked about the money that's been given to the Tories from the Russians. But I think people are, I don't want to pull this into factional intra-political fighting, because it just feels to me like every time we talk about Russia or Trump or Brexit, or it, instead of talking about what is going wrong, what we try to do is filter it through how can we have the fight we've always had. And I think we need to stop having the fight we've always had and look at what the new fights are. And I think that's where a lot of it went wrong in terms of our approach to things like Brexit and why no one saw Trump coming. Because actually, the populists understand what the fights are now, and that's why they win them. And that's we trying to pretend that we still live in a world that we don't live in anymore. And that's why we keep losing. Mark?
Yeah, I think to a large extent that's probably true. I mean, I feel very uncomfortable in this new world, because I always like to think of myself at least as, you know, someone who likes to see things from, you know, both sides or several sides. I always try and weigh things up. I'm not always successful in doing that, but I do try to. But the current world has become so binary now. And also, I mean, when I just look at, I mean, you just mentioned Trump, I look at what Trump's doing and I just, there's nothing, I can't look at that and I can't really ever think that he's well motivated. To me, it is like the emperor has no clothes, and it's like I can see him completely naked and I know exactly what's going on, and he's just a complete egomaniac and he's just doing whatever he can do to solve his own ego. And I don't really understand how there is anyone who can't see that. I can't put myself in the position of someone who thinks that Trump is doing a good job, because I just can't see it. When it comes to Brexit, I'm slightly more equivocal. I do think it's going to be bad, but as we've discussed in previous episodes, I can see how it could possibly be good in, say, 10 or 20 years' time. And I can see that there are people who voted Brexit who did so from a position that was well-motivated and well-meaning. I just simply can't see that with Trump. I just can't. And I don't like the way the discourse has gone. I don't think it's surprising that a party like the Lib Dems that I used to be a member of, and I'm still to a certain extent a fellow traveller with, is down to 7% in the polls. This isn't the time for people and parties who kind of, you know, want to straddle the political divide and want to try and see things from different sides. And it just isn't. It's, you know, you're either with Corbyn or you're against him. You're either with Trump or you're against him. You're either for Brexit or you're an enemy of the people and a saboteur. It just isn't the time for people like me. I'm actually not sure if it will be again in my active political lifetime. It's quite sad, really.
Well, at least the one optimistic thing for you, Mark, is things change very quickly at the moment. So who knows? Just because something's like it is today doesn't mean it's going to be like it tomorrow. And that's and considering you're really terrible at predictions, then that means probably next week everything's going to be, Lib Dems are going to storm the next election and become the biggest party.
Yay! Hooray for terrible predictions.
Yeah, but
you're also really bad at predictions. So now you've really screwed that.
is this like crossing the streams in Ghostbusters now?
It is. It's like political punditry vortex. It's like a black hole that we're going to dive into. But anyway.
One twin always tells the truth and one twin always lies.
I think you're right, Mark. I mean, we've got into a bigger, broader point here, but ultimately, all I believe that I can do is just tell the truth as I see it, and that's it, really. And it doesn't, you know, this idea of being, shall we say, loyal to a particular party or loyal to a particular sort of set of people or anything like that. I think that has now really gone out the window. I think now you need to be loyal to what you believe to be the truth and have the courage to say it, really. And so obviously I'm definitely still a member of the Conservative Party and all this sort of stuff, but actually what I'm bound to now is what I believe to be true and good, which obviously sounds all grand, because I know I'm very capable of being wrong on many occasions. Well, you did well indeed. So, you know, different people have different opinions, but about that. But But you know, I think that's all you can do in this time. So, but it is you know, it is really scary, to be honest.
Yeah,
it is really scary.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there are easy answers, but I think you're right that as other people and as times harden and become more divided and divisive, it is important that we do keep talking to each other and that we do keep representing our truth, whatever that may be. And it's really hard to do, particularly in areas like politics where everybody is quite factional, everybody is quite sort of ideological and wedded to a certain way of thinking. And so to come out and go, well, I'm just going to take each issue as it comes and not actually just listen, you know, make up my own mind on different things. You know, it actually that marks you out as a bit of a loner. It's quite a difficult, quite lonely place to be. But it is important.
It is. I mean, the thing that, you know, I really dislike most about the current sort of political discourse is essentially almost like the sort of loud certainty that people have to feel like they have to adopt. And the idea that if they give an inch or are open-minded to people from the opposite point of view, that suddenly that makes them weaker. And so you end up in a situation where people just shout at each other and insult each other and can't see that each other, you know, are decent in intention. I mean, I disagree, you know, with a lot of Labour policies, but you know, Labour people are generally decent people who want good things, and I'm happy to listen to stuff and actually, you know, agree on things when they are right. But I think this idea that we have now that, you know, all of the opposition are evil and anything they suggest is terrible, and if they raise issues, then instantly you hammer down them rather than engaging in those issues seriously. And I think we can come on to this when we talk about Brexit. It's just really, really dangerous. And actually is leading, you know, the whole of our society down this black hole, really. Yes. Because life is cheery.
Maybe we should move on to a cheerier international topic. So let's talk about how Brexit's going.
Nice segue there.
I think the thing that we particularly wanted to look at this week was the fact that the European Union have said that they cannot go any further with the negotiations until there is a better answer on the Irish border question. And obviously the problem with the Irish border question is that nobody really thought about it beforehand properly. You cannot have a border between the EU and Northern Ireland that is porous without having alignment in their customs arrangements. And that probably means some form of customs union. But Theresa May has been very explicit in saying that she does not want a customs union. So you will have to have some sort of border. The only kind of, but a border is what will likely kick back into the Troubles. And I certainly am old enough to remember, you know, the IRA bombing London, lots and lots of fighting, and Belfast being a place that you just wouldn't go. And now, you know, we're talking about a place that's been absolutely reborn. And I really worry that we're not going, that, you know, I obviously want us to stay in the customs union. I want us to stay in the single market for lots and lots and lots of reasons. But taking my Remainer head out of the game, I still can't see, even if I were completely politically neutral on Brexit, how you're going to solve the Irish border without either having checks that make it impossible to have cross-border business, which would cripple the economy of both north and south of the island of Ireland, or having a customs union which would cripple the internal politics of the Conservative Party, which is, you know, while I may not care about that particularly, is quite obviously going to be a concern of Theresa May's. So what do we do? You know, what is the answer? Mark, you don't really have a, you know, your political skin in the Tory game, but do you have sympathy for the dilemma that Theresa May's in?
Yes and no. I mean, I have sympathy on a human level that she's trying to solve an unsolvable riddle. And she's doing so whilst trying to hold together her own party, which is riven by this issue and has been ever since I've been politically aware. I mean, I remember the Maastricht debates back in the early 90s. You know, I remember John Major and his bastards comment. You know, that was 20 plus years ago. You know, this has been going on for generations. Mm. And there is no solution to it. I mean, we talked in a previous episode about how Brexit is a process rather than an event. And it is, and it is an ongoing process. Part of the reason why I don't really feel sorry for Theresa May, though, is that I think she's played her hand terribly badly. It feels like the EU is playing chess and she's playing Ludo. It just, you know, this latest thing that has happened about the Irish border, as in there will be no further discussions, we won't advance the negotiations any further until the Irish border is sorted. I mean, that's just a really good move by the EU, because they could see what was happening. They could see that they were being blamed. There was talk about they were trying to annex Northern Ireland, yeah. And you know, from some of the wingnuts on the right. I don't think many people took that seriously, but the fact that was being said at all demonstrated the tenor of the debate. And so they've just said, "Well, you sort it out then." Like, they don't have to do anything. They could just run down the clock, let Article 50 run out, and then just throw us to the wolves. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why triggering Article 50 when we did was just stupid. You know, I've been involved in various negotiations over the years in various businesses I've been involved with, including one I used to run myself. And we haven't even got the basics right here. You know, anchoring, you know, something when it comes to negotiation, you want to be the one to try and set the expectation and any floor and any ceiling in any negotiation to suit you. And we haven't issued documentation. We haven't taken that opportunity. So the EU, just in its own slightly kind of bureaucratic way, but kind of relentless, remorseless bureaucratic way, has just taken the lead in all these areas. And the reason why we haven't is because the Tory party is split. And as soon as Theresa May jumps one way, half of the party will try and kill her, metaphorically. I don't see how we get out of this. I'm sounding very, very pessimistic tonight, but I genuinely don't see how this is resolved. It certainly isn't going to be resolved in any way that's good for anyone.
Nick, can you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Actually, I can. Well, firstly, I think the sad truth is that most people in the UK don't really care about Northern Ireland. Otherwise, if they would have cared about Northern Ireland, then this would have been a bigger issue during the Brexit referendum. But when it was raised in the issue, people just brushed it aside. And I think ultimately, unfortunately, you know, most people in the UK don't really take that much of an interest in it. But one thing I'd say that gives a light at the end of the tunnel is that the UK crashing out of the EU and the Irish border problem not being solved actually is a problem for Ireland. It's a problem for the EU as well. So the EU at the moment are doing some very good negotiation tactics. And what they're doing essentially is they're highlighting the massive issue and intellectual problem with Brexit by using the Irish border. And that is really sort of putting us in knots, and in a sense, rightly so, because, you know, as I agree with you, Mark, I mean, triggering Article 50 when we didn't know what type of Brexit we wanted and how some of the sort of main concerns would be sorted out is absolutely barmy. But anyway, it's what we did. But I don't think it's in the EU's interest to actually not find a solution to this problem, which is the light at the end of the tunnel, basically. And as a being a, you know, bit of a geek on these matters and sort of working partly in areas that are interested in these matters, I've read a lot of stuff about the negotiations, a lot of the documents. And really, I think essentially both sides do agree that a deal needs to be done, and it'll either be Canada Plus or Canada Plus Plus, which is basically a sort of enhanced free trade agreement. It just depends how enhanced it is. And I think that will happen because both sides know that an agreement along those lines will need to happen. Now, in terms of the Irish border, I think essentially they're going to have to come up with some sort of system where people going across the border you know, is quite a very simple process, but obviously, bulkier items and all this sort of stuff becomes a more serious process. I mean, essentially, we are going to have a border, and we're going to have some form of customs checks, even if it's light customs checks. And I think you just cannot get away from that if you're outside the customs union and single market, which is, the strong position of the government.
But the problem with that, as I understand it, is that there are businesses, particularly some agricultural or dairy product businesses, where they're crossing several times a day with, different bits of products. To come together in a process that is currently working on both sides of the border, and that would just make their entire business is unviable. And this is my understanding, and that's not a small issue. That's quite a lot of businesses that, along the border, that work like that. And I think that's probably been a deliberate strategy in order to get Ireland, post Good Friday Agreement, to get into a place where everyone knew each other better, were working together. That, so that's quite often a big part of a peace process.
Yeah, I mean, but then for that sort of situation, that solutions need to be found. So licenses, for example, for known businesses, or things are going to be more complicated. Things, there is going to be more paperwork, there is going to be more costs, and it's going to be more awkward. But that is Brexit. there is no magic formula to the Irish border problem. And essentially, they're going to have to come up with a system which is as best possible within what the government believes Brexit means.
And we can't change the government's mind on what Brexit could possibly mean, because that seems the more simple solution.
Only with a general election, that's not going to happen. Actually, I say that's not going to happen, but to be honest, I mean, Mark's right, really. I mean, it's very possible that whatever agreement is reached, the government agrees, and then part of the Tory party rejects it, and if Labour rejects it as well, then the government comes crashing down and we have an election, and that election will be a sort of default election on what the deal is. And that is possible, actually.
So that election would act as a second referendum?
Sort of, yes. Yeah.
That's a problem, obviously. I don't want another election yet. I was just saying before we started, I'm going away in September to the place where I had to cut my holiday short because of the election last year. So there better not be a blooming election. I think really importantly, I don't think the Tories want to have an election. I think the Tories want to avoid an election at all costs, is certainly my sense. Nick, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. But then obviously, because the majority is so slim, there are, to use Mark's wonderful phrase, there are wingnuts on both sides of the parties who might think that actually, it's more important that what they believe to happen should happen, and will risk a general election. So two extreme examples, obviously Anna Soubry on the Remain side and Jacob Rees-Mogg on the Leave side. Though neither of them wants a general election, but I could see them basically voting in what they believe to be the national interest.
So future Tory leader Jacob Rees-Mogg brings down the government, gets to them. I suppose that gets him into number 10 quicker, doesn't it? Or at least it gets him to the Tory party.
He would do it because he would believe in a certain type of Brexit. I don't think it would be a sort of career move as such. I do find it ironic that, obviously one of the main sort of thrusts of the argument for Brexit is obviously take back control. And if taking back control allows a socialist to take control of this country, that's part of taking back control. But I don't know, really. Let's be honest, because we don't really have a position, it's in the EU's gift. The stability of this government is now in the EU's gift.
Well, it's a good thing we're being so polite about them then. Well, the one thing isn't in the government's gift, but is in all our gift, is to behave better at work. There was a report on Newsnight this week about abuse in the Houses of Commons, which, while I think shocked everyone and surprised nobody, would that be fair? We've seen that staff members have been harassed and bullied by MPs, or at least that's the accusation. The MPs are denying it. There's been Debbie Abrahams from the Labour Party has lost her shadow cabinet role over an accusation of bullying again, which she denies. And I believe the Speaker of the House is one of the people who was named in the Newsnight report. Again, you know, this just seems to be going on and on. You know, we had the Pestminster sexual harassment scandals that came out just before Christmas. This is a sort of an extension of that. But, it, you know, the House of Commons is the most archaic workplace in the world, isn't it? You know, what should, you know, Nick, you are very, very keen on talking from a conservative perspective about workers' rights. So what do you think should be done to ensure that the people who make our democracy work can do so safely?
I think the most important thing is culture, and culture emanates really from leadership. Obviously we can't take the politics out of Westminster, but if the leaders of the main parties and the whips operated a no tolerance policy to bullying and basically punished those who behaved completely unacceptably, then the behaviour would be minimised a lot. And I found two things pretty disturbing about the reaction to the Newsnight report, which those who are around Westminster, it won't surprise them that these sort of things have happened, because you know it's known about. And that was the first thing that sort of, you know, is depressing. In all the instances, the cases that have come up, such as in the international development sector in Hollywood, this stuff was all known. It's just people didn't really say it out loud. So for a long time, bad behaviour, terrible behaviour, has been excused and allowed. So, you know, and I think we should all look at ourselves for that. But also, secondly, the other depressing thing is that the excuses and the reasons that were used in order to sort of excuse behaviour were all very technical and wishy-washy. Ultimately, there were the examples of the MPs that were used. You know, there were three or four different people who basically had breakdowns or had issues or, you know, or felt intimidated. And so it doesn't matter what the technicality of is. Was it bullying or was it harassment? What matters is that people's behaviour had led to other people feeling in a way that they should not feel. And that needs to be looked at. So the overly defensive reaction and the not self-awareness of those who are causing the problem. I'm certainly not going to name names, but I have seen examples of people who, you know, very much will stand up and campaign for, you know, workers' rights and equality and all this sort of stuff. And then I will know how they treat their staff and what they expect from their staff. And what they do is how they treat their staff is so far away from their rhetoric that I don't understand how they can say they believe in one thing and then treat people who they look at in the face every day in another way.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, lots of us have been through workplace bullying, things like this. I mean, I have, and it's absolutely soul destroying, because the problem with it happening in your place of work is that you know you have to go there every day. You can't, you know, if you were being bullied in a social situation, you can get yourself out of that. But you have to go to work. And if someone is bullying you at work, or someone is belittling you at work, or someone is making you feel every day like you're worthless, that's really hard to then know when you go home at night and you lie in your bed and you know that in 8 hours you're going to have to get up and do it all again. And it is absolutely crushing. You know, it's the worst feeling I've ever had, and I have experienced it. And, you know, oftentimes people aren't able to escape that. And if they aren't able to escape it, and a lot of times people are a lot more junior, You know, these are not generally people who are in the more senior roles that this is happening to. And they're just considered expendable. It doesn't matter. They're not important enough. And this is, you know, you're absolutely right. It's the culture that treats them like that. It's the culture that treats the victims as if they're expendable and allows people to believe in their own importance enough to think they can get away with these behaviours. And we just have to, I mean, it has to be time's up, doesn't it? There's just not really much more to say than you just can't behave like that. Mark, I mean, what would, I mean, in terms of practical things, you've run businesses. What would you do in practical terms to change things?
I mean, it's such a difficult problem to try and tackle because it's so endemic and you're talking about human nature. I mean, particularly in the case of the Houses of Parliament, but it applies as well to situations like in Hollywood and like, say, in television or in journalism or the media more generally. You've got a very, very, very stark power disparity between the people at the top and the people who are working for those people. I mean, in the case of MPs, they have the power of patronage. They can, you know, someone's political career and the lower echelons will be made or broken on the basis of whether an MP wants to help them advance their career. It's the same in Hollywood. It's the same in the media more generally. And, you know, that I think that's why we see this happening over and over again. I mean, I remember the Chris Renard scandal a few years ago, which I know you, Emma, talked to Jo Swinson about in your excellent interview with her that we released a few days ago. And I mean, I was just horrified at what happened there, particularly because, I mean, I actually knew some of the details. One of the people, one of the women who had been his victim, actually, I spoke to her privately and she told me all the details of what happened. It was absolutely disgusting. And the result was that the four women who complained about him all left the Lib Dems. He's still in the Lib Dems. And that's just a little example of what happens in this sort of situation. That wasn't that long ago. That was only a few years ago. And so I don't think there is an easy answer to this. But I think we just need to keep shining a spotlight on it. I think John Bercow should be suspended whilst he's investigated. Mm. I think there's hypocrisy going on here because he's the first to call out other people. He should be suspended. You know, there's a real double standard that goes on in these situations. You know, and again, you see, I mean, we saw this recently with the charities as well, didn't we? Again, a similar sort of power disparity dynamic going on there where there were problems in some charities. And when people complained about what was happening, people were being harassed, people were being bullied. It was just, you know, the upper echelons all kind of closed ranks and just made sure that it went nowhere. And it was only when there was an investigation by a dogged BBC reporter that there's been any results there. It's just that this just thing just goes on and on and on. I think sunlight is the best disinfectant. I think we need to shine a light on it. And Nick, what you just said earlier on about naming no names, I totally get it. And I'm not expecting that you should. But I think more people need to name names in situations like this. It's difficult because of legal ramifications and you don't want to be saying things when you're not sure whether they're true or not. But I just think, you know, if someone is a bully, they need to be called upon it. You know, they need to be called out
I mean, they do, but obviously the examples that I know of, you know, are people that I know that it's happened to. It's not been to me, so it would be wrong for me to sort of expose the people who told, you know, so... but I think the real key point, and I think is that you know, the leadership has to say in all these areas it's not acceptable. And you know, in the situation you gave, Emma, for example, I mean, in an ideal business, if you felt in that way, you should be able to approach the business and tell them, you know, and it should be investigated. And you know, sometimes these things happen because of misunderstandings, and if that is the case, and that can be nipped in the bud and this issues can be dealt with you know, quickly but sensitively, sometimes they are actually bad people who, you know, people you know, are scared or don't want to deal with, and they're allowed to sort of create a negative atmosphere, then the organization needs to deal with that. I mean, too often in situations, people feel like they can't complain, which then perpetuates those who behave badly. And I think that is the key, really. I mean, if there was a system that people trusted, so in the House of Parliament, for example, people don't complain because they don't feel like that anything will happen apart from they will get punished. And to be honest, and that is what happens. And so those who behave badly or can continue behaving badly because they're not called out on it. And I think no system that the House of Commons or House of Parliament puts in place will mean anything unless it's extremely clear what the punishment is for those who behave badly. And also, if it's not completely clear that if somebody defends their actions, but then a number of people are struggling to work with them, then it doesn't matter if they defend their actions. What matters is the impact they have on other people and that they understand that and change their behaviour. So unless those two boxes are ticked, it doesn't matter what the Houses of Parliament come up with.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there does need to be a robust system, but that robust system and probably an independent system, but that system absolutely has, you know, a system is only as good as its implementation, and that is key to this. And that implementation will only happen if we are willing to have it applied to our best mates as well as our worst enemies. And that's the problem.
Definitely.
Well, gosh, it's been a bit of a depressing week all round. Sorry, guys. We hope you've enjoyed listening anyway. If you have enjoyed listening to the podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you would take just a moment to rate and review us on iTunes. If you haven't enjoyed it, don't worry.
Don't leave a comment.
Yeah. but it just leaves me now to say thank you, Mark and Nick, for a wonderful discussion as always.
No, it's been a pleasure.
And to say thank you to Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.